Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Welcome to Sylvia and Me. I'm Fran Pastore, CEO of the Women's Business Development Council.
Fran, I am so delighted to have you here today with me and my sore throat, but we are going to get through this. You're not only the CEO of the Women's Business Development Council, you're also the founder, and you're, which is, we'll go into more exactly what the council is, but you also served, I'm going to give a little bit of background. You served a three-year term as an appointed member to the President's National Women's Business Council. You're an independent source of advice and counsel to the President, Congress, and the U.S. Small Business Administration. You serve on the board of Women Impacting Public Policy. In conjunction with the U.S. State Department and University of Connecticut's Office of Global Affairs, you taught women entrepreneurs in rural Costa Rica, and I could go on and on with your background. What I would really like to do to get this started off is, can we go back to why you established and founded this council?
Thank you. Thanks so much, Sylvia, for having me and for your interest in learning more about our work. Yes. How and why did I start the Women's Business Development Council? And so I'll start at the beginning. I found myself at a very young age, 25 years ago, a single unemployed mom with two little girls, 2 and 4 years old. And I find myself going from having this, fairly lovely Fairfield County life to being economically challenged, and having a lot of looking days at the Stanford Town Center, not buying days. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with myself, how I was going to support these two little girls. I had always been interested in small business. I had always been interested in women's economic equity and financial education. But in college, my only job experience had been a very brief stint on Wall Street, which I did not want to go back to. I didn't want to commute. And as I said earlier, I had always believed in women's equality, women's economic equity, and I loved small business. But at the time that I was in college and the school that I went to, which was based on Wall Street, in Wall Street, there was not a lot of talk about going into any other field of work but business. And while I was very active on campus in a lot of nonprofit initiatives, I never thought that there was a career in that.
Well, when I was growing up and when I went to college, one of the things that everyone thought of was you graduated and you went to a corporation,
right?
Because that's where security,
exactly,
was.
That was our generation. Exactly. And so it wasn't really so much about, for me anyway, coming from a very provincial Italian family where you get a job, you stay there to your point, and you don't leave because you have security. Working at the New York Stock Exchange was a very male-dominated environment. There was incredible sexual harassment. This is in the early 80s, mid-80s. And fast forward, I left, found myself living in Connecticut, no family. What I had was a community of girlfriends. I had these amazing, highly educated friends who came to my aid and were trying to help me figure out what that thing was that I was going to do. And I learned at that time, with the help of my friends, that Connecticut was the only state in the country that did not have a resource for women entrepreneurs. And the little background to that is that in 1988, a law was passed called the Women's Business Ownership Act of 1988 at the federal level. And that law did a number of things, not the least of which was allowed women to access capital in their own name for commercial purposes without having a male cosigner for the first time in history.
Yes, unbelievable. And it's not that long ago.
31 years ago.
Yeah.
31 years ago. The other thing, it did a couple of things, but the other thing that it did was that it established an office within the federal government, within the Small Business Administration, called the Office of Women's Business Ownership. And the purpose of the Office of Women's Business Ownership was to help advance women entrepreneurs, helping them launch and scale. And there were small grants that that office provided to nonprofit organizations around the state. The goal at the time was to have one educational institution for women entrepreneurs in every state. That was in 1988. Fast forward to 1995, I'm this single unemployed mom looking for that thing that I'm going to do. And I stumble upon the fact that Connecticut was the only state in the country that did not have access to those funds. So no Connecticut nonprofit had accessed those funds, and therefore Connecticut women were not getting the resources that they needed. And so at that moment, my passion aligned with a need in my community, which is how entrepreneurs are born. And with a lot of help from a lot of those girlfriends and a lot of guy friends in the state of Connecticut, the Women's Business Development Council was formed.
So what is really the definition of an entrepreneur? I mean, a lot of people own businesses. Is everyone who owns a business considered an entrepreneur?
I think that that definition can be disputed. And I think that there are many definitions or ideas around what that definition of an entrepreneur is. But an entrepreneur, by definition, is someone who takes a risk. And for me, anybody who is out there on their own, whether you're a consultant with a private practice, or whether you're working on, the next big drug for cancer treatment, you're an entrepreneur. And so here at WBDC, the women that we work with are really solopreneurs, the majority of them. They are either in business for themselves and they have one or two other employees, but the majority of our clients have less than three employees. And then right now what you're hearing about is a lot of, you know, the entrepreneurs that somehow come to mind are the Mark Zuckerberg and the Steve Jobs. Yeah, they're entrepreneurs with big ideas, but not all entrepreneurs have big ideas like that. And that certainly, as I said, entrepreneur, the word entrepreneur resonates in many different ways with many different people.
But is everyone really built to be an entrepreneur?
No. I mean, the key quality, key characteristic of an entrepreneur is a risk taker. That is the most, that's the hallmark, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, of what one of the main ingredients to be an entrepreneur is. I mean, an entrepreneur identifies a need in a particular space and seeks to fill it. In order to do that, you have to have a lot of chutzpah. You have to have a lot of backing. You know, when you talk about Apple and you talk about Facebook and Google, you know, most of those started at a kitchen table, just like many of the women-owned businesses that we work with here at WBDC. But the key ingredient is being able to take a risk. And if you are adverse to risk, if you have trouble handling the ups and downs, and not only emotional, but financial ups and downs, you know, you may or may not succeed. Some people prefer a more predictable life and being the beneficiaries of creations like Apple and Google and some of the other large companies that were founded by tech entrepreneurs. But not everybody prefers that life.
Well, there's also, would you consider an entrepreneur somebody who actually works with somebody side by side, a startup, and they're taking a risk?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not everyone is out there being that one key person,
exactly.
But that one key person usually needs some kind of support, whether it be, it doesn't make a difference what that role is, but there always is someone.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, if you think about Facebook, you think about Sheryl Sandberg. If you think about, you know, so many, I mean, I think about not many people would say that I'm an entrepreneur, but I am. You know, well, I took a big risk.
Well, the same thing I could say for myself, which I have for many years, is I've always worked with startups. Mm-hmm. Now, sure. I haven't been the sole owner of the startup, but to me, it was taking a risk. For me, back when I had my two children and was a single mom back in 1988, my security was knowing that I was going to get a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And now, mind you, because they're startups, you never know whether they're going to actually succeed. But my passion has always been startups, mm-hmm. because I just love seeing from beginning to end.
It's a wonderful feeling. I never thought I would be here 23 years later, but here we are.
Here we are. And one of the things that I've come across is that there's 114% more women entrepreneurs than there were 20 years ago.
Yes. And I really credit a lot of that to the work that a lot of organizations, like a lot of national organizations and the Small Business Administration, have done to provide resources like WBDC to women entrepreneurs, to give them a place to go.
Yes, definitely. It's not just a place to go, but also a place to bump off ideas.
Mm-hmm. Support, resources, guidance, that's what we do.
Which is, you know, phenomenal. There's, you know, the U.S. has 12.3 million women-owned businesses. Now, where do you see the growth? I know that a lot of, as we're called, baby boomers, mm-hmm. are starting their own businesses, some because they've finally realized that they can go after their passion, mm-hmm. and others out of sheer necessity. Mm-hmm. Where do you see a lot of baby boomers coming in, women in their
Absolutely.
Late 50s, 60s, Absolutely. Wanting to all of a sudden something that they've wanted to do before, were never able to do it, didn't think they'd be able to do it. So how do you go about putting them on the track? Some people have ideas that just aren't realistic. But from what I see, you know, there's more chapters of life. So how do you go about getting someone to get that empowerment within themselves to move forward?
Well, let me say that I heard a term recently called silverpreneur. And I understand that that's one of the fastest growing segments of the entrepreneurial market. So a majority of those are women. So a couple of things. One is that I think that the new women's movement, as I'll call it, which, you know, launched just a few years ago, has really given, has become a source of, I think, confidence and inspiration for a lot of women who have said, you know what, I've always wanted to do this. I'm at the place in my life and the age and stage in my life where I have more wisdom, more confidence, and more money. And so I have the time that I can invest to really think about that thing that I can get off the ground that I've always wanted to do. In all honesty, the kinds of people that are coming into WBDC, we have seen an increase in younger women and in that baby boomer population as well, and everything in between. So I really believe that the good thing that's come out of this, I don't like to characterize it as the Me Too movement, but the positive impact of that has given people space to think about themselves and their life in a different way and what they want to achieve and accomplish on their own. And so I think that has provided the motivation and the stimulation to do that. That said, I think women in general are feeling that way, whether they're in the corporate sector or they're entrepreneurs. And, you know, I talk to a lot of corporations who don't have a pipeline of women for senior management positions. You know, when you look around the room, when you look at, I mean, you don't have to really look any further than our Congress and our state government to see that there are less women in positions of leadership across the board in every sector of our economy. And we have to really come up with ways to change that, because that's how the dialogue will change. That is how we will have inclusion, and that is how women will have a voice in the laws and conversations that are taking place more often than not about them and their bodies. But in order to do that, we need to make room for them at the table, and we'll see how that progresses. We've made a lot of progress, but there's a lot more to go.
What do you think the biggest obstacle is?
Well, I think one of the reasons why women opt out of corporate life, especially, and opt into an entrepreneurial venture is because we are still the main caregivers. And I think until we really have affordable universal child care,
So agree.
That we are never going to see women at the top echelons of our society. And so when I'm talking to a lot of these corporations, which because WBDC relies on corporate contributions, I talk to a lot of folks, senior corporate folks, who are always looking to hire more women. There are all kinds of diversity initiatives, and especially for women, minority women, women of color, Latina women. And for them, the obstacles around child care are even greater. So for me, starting WBDC gave me the latitude that I needed to be present for my kids. It was, a small organization. I was able to live and work in the community that my kids went to school in, and I became actively engaged in my community as a result, and I was available for my children. I had childcare. Looking back, I don't know how I did it, and I have to say, without that flexibility, I would never have been able to raise the two young women that I raised. So in order for us, if we truly want women's voices heard and represented, and we know from everybody from Kevin O'Leary to the Uber scandal last year, or debacle last year, one of the reasons that there was an Uber debacle was because there were no women sitting at the table making decisions about how the company would structure and run, right? And who were the main users of Uber?
Women. Women.
Who were the main purchasers of all goods and services? Women. That trend is going to continue for decades to come. How do these corporations then have their employees look like their major constituents, who's purchasing their goods and services? So unless the childcare issue is addressed, women will never be able to achieve in the numbers that we need them to be represented at. They'll never be able to get to where we really need to be.
I so agree, and I agree because I was there. I was there in 1988. I was a single mom with a 4-year-old and 18-month-old. Uh-huh. And I at first lived in New York for a little bit. New York was one of the states that actually subsidized mm-hmm. childcare. Coming out to Connecticut, there was no such thing.
I remember we talked about that, yeah.
And when I first came out, the thing back then was it was less expensive or cheaper, as I would say, to get a live-in nanny, mm-hmm. supposedly.
Supposedly, yeah.
Until they ate everything, really
yes,
weren't watching
yeah.
your kids, weren't there for anything. So it's such a quagmire that we wind mm-hmm. up getting into. And one of the things, whenever I would hire anyone, you're not allowed to ask personal questions. But I would start talking and telling them my story so that they would be able to feel comfortable to open up. Because guess what? If we opened up and we didn't feel that we would be penalized because we have to care for our children, and women are the primary caregivers, no matter how much men do, the fathers do want to contribute. The time that is spent with the child during the week is primarily the mother. So that, to me, is one of the biggest issues. I'm glad you brought that up. What else do you see as far as, I know that it's always been said that funding is one of the, is an obstacle that a lot of women will come up against. How do they kind of break down some of those barriers that are there?
By educating themselves. you know. I think that, as I shared with you earlier, it was only 31 years ago that we could actually apply for a loan or get a loan, a commercial loan, without having a male co-signer. So
unbelievable.
There's a lot of residual bias that still exists. And again, until the people on the other side of the table look more like we do. I mean, there are all kinds of studies about a man and a woman with the same resume, the same credit score, the same business plan, go to get financing. The male gets the financing, and the woman has to go back to the drawing board at least 6 times before she'll be considered. There are a couple of schools of thought around that. One for me is the women that I see coming in here. And I would, you know, include myself in this. I was not financially adept or skilled. It was not something that I grew up with. That is also a societal.
Yeah, it's very much so.
Right? So, what I see is our clients come in here and they don't have a personal budget. They don't have a handle on their personal budget. And they've been in business for 5 years and they still don't know if they're making a profit. And so, I say that it's great to have a passion around your business and it's great to be an expert in that particular field, but you need to have someone on board or at least understand how to articulate your numbers and work with a finance expert. So that's what we have here at WBDC. We'll have somebody work with you to make sure that you can put your budget in place, that you have a personal household budget, and that your personal goals align with this business initiative that you are launching or scaling. So I still see that as one of the obstacles. We can't blame gender bias for everything.
No.
It's a big piece of what exists, but a lack of preparedness needs to be addressed, and it cannot be left up to, you know, you have to take the initiative to do that and be prepared. That way, you know that you've left no stone unturned and you are prepared when you walk into a lender to put your best foot forward. And if you get rejected for other reasons, well, then you get rejected. But yes, access to capital still becomes the main issue because the majority of women-owned businesses have gross, 90% of women-owned businesses in the country and around the globe have gross revenues of under $1 million. So these are not necessarily businesses that need hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in capital. So they're not necessarily the businesses. So when you hear about only 1.9% of women get venture capital, I'm going to say that that's because the majority of women-owned businesses have less than $1 million in revenue.
And don't.
And maybe are not prepared for that.
Exactly.
On the other end of the spectrum, sometimes, you know, our clients need $50,000 or $100,000 or $300,000. You need to be prepared. And you need to learn how to talk to investors and talk to lenders to be in a position of strength.
Well, you know, one of the things that has been tough to crack, and I think women are finally getting a handle on it, is that, you know, growing up in past generations, the woman always left all of her financial decisions
yes.
to a spouse, to, you know, the male, because the male was supposed to know and take care. And, you know, mm-hmm. nowadays there's about 80% of women who all of a sudden are alone, be it through divorce or widowhood, and have all these financial, I didn't know that. And the education, I think women are now becoming more educated. They're becoming more educated on finance. They're also becoming more educated with, you know, what's been going on in the last few years with this, you know, movement as to being able to have the confidence in themselves
mm-hmm.
and stand up for themselves. And you know, how do you stand up for yourself without being looked at as a real... you know, that word, you know, it's...
Well, that's not their problem.
Right.
That's not our problem. That's somebody else's problem.
Exactly.
That is just not our problem. And I will not accept any responsibility for that because, I as a woman don't accept responsibility for my sisters.
Exactly.
Because our job is to participate fully and to do everything that we can to be knowledgeable and educate ourselves about particular issues. And I am personally tired of looking at a room full of a bunch of white men making decisions about me and my body and the body of my children. So we must become civically engaged. And if we're not civically engaged, as a very good friend of mine says, you're dead.
Exactly.
You need to be civically engaged, regardless of what side of the aisle you stand on. And you need to educate yourself about the issues that are important to you. And we need to empower our daughters to do the same. One of the things that I love, I just heard the other day, is that two of my friends, their daughters are going after their, you know, second job out of college, and they weren't happy with the salary that was being offered. And so both of my friends said, I told her to ask for more. And she did, and she got it. And so that's one of my big beliefs in life, is ask and you shall receive.
It can't hurt to ask. And that is something that I've seen a lot of young people not being afraid anymore to do.
Well, I think if we're talking still about young women, there's two things. One of those things is that the biggest obstacle to anyone's success is confidence.
Totally.
And we see it every day here. And there are days when I'm feeling not very confident about myself. My girlfriend sent me a little cartoon on New Year's Day, and it was really funny, and it said, Happy New Year. May you have all the confidence of a guy who came up with a ridiculous idea and received millions of dollars in funds and then went bankrupt.
Okay.
Or belly up, you know.
Right.
So that's one of my favorite quotes. But the other thing is about confidence is that there's also comfort. And I think women have to become more comfortable with money and wanting wealth and pursuing wealth and making financial decisions. I dread talking to my financial advisor because I got to think about money. But that's all part of how we, our blueprint of life, how we grew up. And as a boomer, as a baby boomer, you know, I wasn't cultivated or bred to think about money or to think about any of that. And so I've always stayed away from it. And that's one of my passions here at WBDC, is making women more comfortable with equality around, you know, financial and economic equality. And so women getting comfortable with wealth and the power that they have. As we said earlier, the decision-making, you know, over 90% of the financial household decisions are made by women. So we're making the decisions. We're starting to make the money. We have identified the barriers that we have. We just need to get the confidence to be able to take the next step.
Okay. So we've talked about young people coming out of college nowadays.
Pardon me.
Sometimes. Where do you think they should be going? What should they be really focused on? Is it to go after their passion, or do you think they should be getting into, you know, the work environment to kind of get accustomed to working, to dealing with people and learning what business is all about before they march out on their own, if they're going to?
Well, I'm a firm believer in that college is not for everybody.
Oh,
I think we've made a very big mistake as a society by forcing people to think that college was the only avenue to pursue.
I think there are
a lot of underutilized technical schools, especially right here in Connecticut. We've got some great technical high schools that are probably underutilized. And apprenticeships and manufacturing, certainly in Connecticut, is on the rise. And we need to find alternative ways to educate people to fill the jobs that are available. So do I think that graduating from college and, you know, going and finding your job, I mean, it's such a personal thing, and I don't think that we have done a good job of giving people the latitude to make decisions. Some people have to work. I had to work. I had no choice. I couldn't think about, oh, maybe I want to do this or that. I didn't have that choice. Had I had a more progressive upbringing and exposure to different kinds of people and other resources. And before our conversation today, I met with another colleague who helps to expose, create internship opportunities for low to moderate income young women, the majority of whom are young women of color, so that they can understand, you know, what they might be interested in, what they might like, and to give them access to contacts and resources that the environment that they are in doesn't allow for them. And we know that 90% of internships are secured through a family friend or a personal connection. And so a lot of low to moderate income kids don't get that opportunity because they don't have the resource. I didn't have those resources. And so I didn't have the freedom of thought, like many of us, that, ooh, I could go into this field, or I could try that, or yes, I could have my own hair salon, which is something I actually wanted. And so I think that we have to encourage people more to seek apprenticeships and seek internships. And we need to make sure that we're providing those opportunities to young people, regardless of their socioeconomic background, because they deserve the chance to think about what it is they want to do, rather than following this prescriptive path that may or may not lead to the career that they want.
It's not only that. As you just said, not everyone belongs in college.
Right.
No matter where they come from, they don't
exactly.
belong in college.
Exactly.
There are so many, what I love to see now, are there are so many young people, millennials, who went to a trade school and
yes.
are doing absolutely
yes.
fantastic, and they're doing what they're passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
They really love
what they're
doing. Yeah,
trade schools, all of those things need to be out there for everybody.
And they're not. When the young people graduate from high school, you know, the high schools are usually focused so much on what college.
Yes.
Have you gotten your applications in? And to your point, it would be really nice to see them educated on alternatives to college. And they're not really alternatives. They're alternatives to what we perceive as a four-year
mm-hmm.
education.
Right. Well, I think also colleges can do a much better job helping people think about the kind of life that they want to live at an earlier age. What kind of lifestyle do you want? Well, how do you want to live? And when you can think about how you want to live, even though you're only 17, you know, you can think about, you know, a lot of people that I talk to. I have a friend who has done extraordinarily well for himself. And his motivation was that his father was a gardener for wealthy people who lived in 10,000 square foot homes in Westchester County. And he would go on his days off from school and on the weekends and help his father mow the lawns. And his father would work 12-hour days. And he said, someday I'm going to live in one of these big houses. And now he has many of those big houses. That was his motivation. You know, everybody needs a different modus operandi, if you will, right? And so having that little opportunity of working with his father was like his little internship,
right.
gave him that experience. As I referenced the woman who I met with before you came in, Sherry West from Live Girl, you know, they're looking to create internship opportunities, whether it's in an office or, you know, working for the Stanford Downtown Special Services, which is something my kids did, setting up for the concerts, you know, schlepping the ice barrels out, schlepping the drinks out, setting up the bleachers, you know, for the concerts. All of that is providing opportunities, and that's what we have to do better at.
It's providing opportunities, and it's allowing young people to actually experience things that they didn't think they'd want to, they didn't realize were out there, and
right.
and turn out to be either fun or interesting,
mm-hmm. exactly.
or maybe they thought this is what they always wanted to do, and guess what? Now that they've done it,
they don't
want
exactly.
to do it. I mean, it's all taking a chance.
Yes.
Fran, what message, if you had a message to send out to women you know, I'm thinking, do I want to ask you, women baby boomers, women millennials, just in general, mm-hmm. what would that message be?
It's, you know, I really feel like there's a call to become civically engaged. You know, we have an election coming up in 2020, and I think we have to harness the power of our sisterhood. And I mean this regardless of what side of the political aisle that you sit on. We have people making decisions for us at the state level and at the federal level who do not look like we do. And a lot of those decisions are being made are about us. And I don't care what your political persuasion is. As a woman, we need to be engaged in the rules, the laws, and the conversations that are happening about us where we don't have a seat at the table. So I would encourage people to get civically engaged. And there are so many opportunities to do so right now. There are so many campaigns to work on, both at the local, state, and national level. You don't have to run for office. You can get involved in doing a number of things. When my kids were, you know, when I my kids who were both very civically engaged, when they were 12, younger, they were standing on corners handing out flyers for candidates that we believed in. We need equality across the board, and we need to get involved. So that's one thing I would say. Okay. Another important thing for women of any age, certainly the younger generation, is to find a sponsor and a mentor. Sponsors and mentors are very different. And a sponsor is going to be the person that talks about you and is advocating for you when nobody else is, or when you're not in the room to do so for yourself. And a mentor is someone that is going to tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly, and help you achieve your goals. So that's the second thing I would say is that's a gift you give yourself. And then lastly, I would say for women entrepreneurs that are out there, or women thinking of starting their business, and women who are in business, utilize the resources that are available to you, whether you're in Connecticut or any other state in the country. There are ways for you to become, you know, you might be an expert at your in your bakery. You might be an expert, you know, loomer of wool, you know, on your loom or your wool loom. You might be an expert in your accounting business. But running a business and having a tribe or a community of women is so important. And you know, finding organizations like WBDC where you can really learn not only the technical skills that you need to launch and run your and scale your business, but where you can find like-minded individuals. And so those are the three things that I would say are so important for the world that we live in today, because we're not short of resources. They're out there. They may be hard to find.
They're hard to find.
But they are out there.
Well, Fran, thank you so much. This has been exceedingly informative. And for more information on Fran and the Women's Business Development Council, you can go to ctwbdc.org. Fran, again, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Sylvia. It was fun.
Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking to another extraordinary woman who has made her mark on the world. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform, and of course, on our website, lifeofprey.com. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to keep up with the latest episodes. Review, rate, and take us with you wherever you go. We want to hear from you. If you know of an extraordinary woman, contact me at sylvia@lifeofprey.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. This has been a Life of Prey production.